from 89.3 KPCC. This is Take Two. I'm Martinez. Happy Pledge Wednesday to you. Coming up, we're going to hear about the cancer-linked chemicals found in several state water systems. That's coming up just ahead. First, though, the Saddle Ridge Fire blanketed much of the San Fernando Valley with ash and smoke last week. But when students in the Valley's LA Unified Schools returned to their classes on Monday, some of their classrooms still were not clean. Now, some parents and staff want to know why the district resumed classes in the Valley before cleaning was complete. KPCC's Kyle Stokes has been all over this story. Hello, Kyle.
Hi there.
All right, so how did the Saddle Ridge fire affect public schools in the Valley? Were they evacuated? Were they closed? What happened?
Yeah, so on Friday, LAUSD decided to cancel classes at 13 sites, and these were generally sites that were closest to, like, in or near the evacuation areas, so up in Granada Hills and Porter Ranch. And this is where sort of the controversy began, and the criticism, the drumbeat of criticism against LAUSD began, because initially the district decided it would just be these 13 sites where classes would be canceled. That left the other 200 plus schools in the San Fernando Valley still operating essentially as usual. The district said, you know, kids should stay inside. But that struck some parents initially as kind of weird, because many of the independent charter schools in the San Fernando Valley, which operate separately from LAUSD, they don't follow LAUSD's orders day to day. Many of the charter schools decided that they would close, you know, very early on Friday. So initially there was sort of some questioning. Why was the district leaving all of these campuses open? And right away, the teachers union stepped up to criticize the district for not following suit with these charter schools and closing all of the schools in the Valley as air quality and traffic got even worse. So fast forward to Monday, when the district decides we're going to send students back to classes on Monday morning, students start arriving. And that's where we begin to see these issues begin to crop up about concerns with cleanliness on these campuses that were close to the evacuation areas.
So what were they seeing? What kind of problems were parents, students, and teachers reporting?
Well, it depends on the campus that you're talking about, but I have heard directly from parents and staff at least five campuses that were in or near evacuation zones. And a lot of the complaints that you hear are a lot the same. Classrooms that were smoky, there was that sort of stench, that after smell of smoke that I know that if you've been near a wildland fire, you know what that smells like.
Yep.
And there was even in some classes a thin layer of ash on surfaces. I was talking to one teacher who said that the first thing she did when she got into her class at Van Gogh Elementary, which is up in the hills of Granada Hills, very close to a burn zone, she went over all of the surfaces in her classroom with baby wipes, and the baby wipes turned black because she showed me pictures of those. And so this was physically uncomfortable for kids. I was talking with another teacher at Van Gogh as well, Robin Reinhardt, who's a second grade teacher there.
My students complained of headaches. My eyes hurt, Mrs. Reinhardt. My throat hurts, Mrs. Reinhardt. Mrs. Reinhardt, my stomach hurts. I feel sick. Can I go wash my eyes out? I don't feel good, Mrs. Reinhardt. Can I go home? Can I call my mom? I was helpless.
Yeah, and so some people did call their parents, and parents did come to pick their children up on some of those days. At least that's what I've been told. And so this is all kind of added up again to this criticism. Why were these campuses open in the first place if the district hadn't had a chance to clean them entirely?
Was LAUSD able to do any cleaning before students went back?
Well, they were able to do some cleaning, according to the district's own statement. But they've also issued a series of updates over the weekend on Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, that kind of make it clear that the cleaning process was still kind of ongoing throughout, even after the decision was made midday Sunday that classes would resume as usual on Monday. So on Sunday, the district said, we've replaced the air filters, we've done some cleaning in classrooms, but the Monday update said that the cleaning in classrooms would continue. The district was going to be providing those, you know, those respiratory breathing masks, like a hospital mask, not the N95 masks were the ones that I've been shown. But they also said, quote, students may be relocated from their regular classroom while cleaning occurs. So there were still cleaning crews that were going around, the district says. And one teacher even described this, saying that she was displaced from her classroom for a couple of hours as crews came in to mop down, rub down, you know, with cloths, the surfaces in her classroom. And as of the Tuesday update, which is the last that I've seen from the district was still cleaning classrooms.
Now, only because I love playing devil's advocate, let's go a different direction here. Let's say the district decided to keep schools in the Valley closed this week while it deep cleaned. If that was the case, wouldn't the district face criticism for keeping kids out of school too long? I mean, after all, kids need a safe place to be.
Yeah, so United Teachers Los Angeles has been the sort of group, this is the union for LAUSD teachers, that has been keeping up the drumbeat of criticism. And I asked him this question, about whether or not, you know, this is sort of a darned if you do, darned if you don't situation. The president of UTLA, Alex Caputo-Pearl, acknowledged that the district did have to make difficult decisions. This was an emergency. The problem that he says is that LAUSD didn't have a coherent plan to help them make those decisions.
Of course, there's going to be tough calls and tough situations. We understand that, and people are human, but you've got to have an overall framework that is ready to make decisions about closing schools, getting schools clean quickly, and not bringing people back into them until they're clean.
Caputo-Pearl said that the district has been through this before and actually successfully handled these situations. Back in 2017, you might remember the Skirball fire, the one that was burning kind of in the 405, the Sepulveda Pass area. That prompted widespread closures across the district because of concerns about air quality. And he says that Caputo-Pearl says that that fire was handled much more coherently. This time, Caputo-Pearl and many of the teachers that I spoke with said that they were getting confusing directives. One of the teachers mentioned that the district's advice to teachers was to have students remain indoors all day because of concerns about outdoor air quality. But the problem was the rooms were so smoky that the most comfortable place for these students to be was actually outdoors. And so contravening this district directive, the teacher said, we're going to have class outside because that's where my students can actually breathe.
Such a tough call, too, right? Because we're talking about parents and kids. They should be the focus. But then there's working parents who maybe drop off their kids. They don't have any other options, right?
Yeah,
they have to drop off their kids at school because they can't take off of work to take care of their kids that aren't in school.
It's a no-win situation. The question is, how do you weigh those things? Yeah. And what UTLA is calling for is a more coherent plan. And they fault top district officials for how this was all handled.
That's KPCC education reporter Kyle Stokes. Kyle, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. It's been a rough couple of days for California's power utilities. State regulators continue to criticize Pacific Gas and Electric after preemptive shutoffs last week left millions in Northern California without power. Governor Gavin Newsom has gone as far as to demand rebates for those affected. Now, meanwhile, where we are, officials are determining whether an electrical tower owned by Southern California Edison played a role in the blaze that's destroyed or damaged over 90 structures. As Californians come to terms with a future that could include more fires and more blackouts, we want to look at a utility that's taken a different approach. That's San Diego Gas and Electric. It's invested heavily in wildfire prevention for over a decade. And for more on where those efforts stand now, let's hear from Brian D'Agostino. He's Director of Fire Science and Climate Adaptation at San Diego Gas and Electric. Brian, welcome.
Well, thank you very much and good day.
Now, the company-wide shift toward preventing wildfires was born out of a spate of wildfires in northern San Diego back in 07. Over 1,200 homes destroyed, two people lost their lives. The California Public Utility Commission ruled that San Diego Gas and Electric was at fault. Brian, what changed after that?
Well, part of what changed after 2007 was a real focus on risk mitigation. Before that, it was always about being compliant with the rules. And we realized that we just had to go far above and far beyond the compliance rules in order to mitigate this increasing risk across California.
That's a big cultural shift, isn't it?
Well, and that's exactly what it is. I mean, it really is changing the culture of the organization. And it takes time, and it takes commitment, and it takes a lot of purpose-driven investment.
So you knew that this wasn't going to happen overnight.
No, and it really has been a decade of work, a decade of innovation, a decade of continuous evolution to really get us to the point now where we understand the Santa Ana winds better than we ever have. We continuously reinvest in hardening the electric infrastructure to make it more resilient to this changing climate. We'll change our operations and how we approach operating the system 365 days a year to mitigate the impact of potentially starting wildfires, and then we collaborate and reach out to the community and work with them in this as well.
Yeah, and San Diego Gas and Electric really beefed up their team with firefighters, meteorologists just like you, even arborists. You're a trained meteorologist. What were you tasked with when they brought you on?
At the base level, my task was to understand Santa Ana winds better. I was the first meteorologist that came on 10 years ago to try to do that, and now we have a team of 5 meteorologists tracking weather every day.
When it comes to understanding the Santa Ana winds, that's something that's befuddled people, Brian, for years and you actually maybe decades. I mean, it's tough to understand and hold the wind in a bottle in a way.
Well, absolutely. I mean, when we were here in San Diego, all the scientific papers that had been written were saying the winds are funneling through the passes and canyons of San Diego County and accelerating. And as we started building what quickly became the largest utility weather network in the world, we put now we have 190 weather stations all across our backcountry. We quickly came to learn that that just wasn't the case here in San Diego. The winds were not being funneled through passes and canyons like we thought.
We're talking to Brian D'Agostino, Director of Fire Science and Climate Adaptation at San Diego Gas and Electric. Now, Brian, your company oversees more than 3,000 miles of lines in high-risk fire areas. So one of the major steps that your team took was adding weather stations to your power poles. What does that allow you to do?
It allows us to get back to that base mission that we had to understand Santa Ana winds better. As we started putting weather stations in every community, every ridgetop, every mountaintop, every canyon, we started to really understand how these winds behave as they funnel through our mountains. And then we were able to really target our investments. Where do we harden the system? And then even as we get into major events, where can we implement these public safety power shutoffs while minimizing the impact on the community?
What specific bits of information do you get from having those weather stations on the power poles?
The very important information is temperature, relative humidity, wind direction, wind speed, and wind gust. From that information, we can really determine the fire danger.
And you can really then focus and isolate what that particular little area might need as opposed to something a few miles down the road?
Yeah, and especially after having these weather stations out there for 10 years, we've collected over a billion pieces of weather data. So then through modern-day data analytics and fire science and artificial intelligence, we can really begin to hone in on the areas that will be most impacted.
You know, Brian, I know that people make plans and then the gods of weather laugh at people's plans. Is there a way to measure success of what you've done so far?
Well, we go in and we always try to validate our forecasts. We always try to improve. And a big way that we can validate what we look at is our ability to minimize the impact on our customers while operating a safe and reliable electric system.
Now, just last week, San Diego Gas and Electric warned 30,000 customers that they may have to cut power due to high winds. Now, despite all of your efforts, Brian, are shutoffs still really the only way or one of the only ways to ensure safety as 100% as possible?
Like we can strategically underground, these public safety power shutoffs are a tool in the toolbox. And we do get such extreme fire weather conditions here in California. We do get to the situation that if fires start, especially as we get into this time of year where we haven't seen rain since the spring, ignitions can pose an immediate threat to life and property. And when it is determined by subject matter experts that that is where we are, and that if there are any ignitions, they will become an immediate threat to people's lives and property, then public safety power shutoff is a tool that is used.
Right. Now that you've done all this research, I got to ask, do you plan to share what you've learned about fire prevention with other utilities or a few other in California that could use maybe the information?
Absolutely. And we, to this day, share everything with universities, the National Weather Service, the community. It is all made publicly available. So any information that is collected and gathered is all made available.
Brian D'Agostino is Director of the Fire Science and Climate Adaptation at San Diego Gas and Electric. Brian, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, moving on. About 300 water wells and other sources of drinking water in California contain traces of toxic chemicals with links to cancer. That's according to new state research. And an LA Times analysis of that data says that two toxic chemicals have been detected in at least 86 of the state water systems that serve about 9 million Californians. Anna Phillips reported on this for the LA Times. Anna, welcome back to Take Two.
Thanks for having me.
Now, these chemicals have some complicated names. Two of the most concerning ones are perfluoroalkyl and polyfluoroalkyl. They've been linked to cancer. Anna, what are they, and how do they end up in our water supply?
So they are part of a massive family of chemicals, and they have been used in manufacturing and in household goods for decades. They were used in Teflon cookware, in Scotchgard, in waterproof fabrics that are in rain jackets and things like that. And they get into our water system through these products as they break down. And they have also been used very heavily as a key ingredient in firefighting foam, which the military adopted and many American airports also adopted. These two most common chemicals, PFAS and PFOA, are no longer manufactured in the U.S., but that's kind of cold comfort because they are manufactured internationally. And so when you have items that are made overseas, they may still have these chemicals in them. So it's not as though they've gone away.
And scientists have called them forever chemicals. Why do they use that term for PFAS?
These chemicals stick around. They don't break down naturally in the environment, and they can also accumulate in our bodies. Most Americans do have some amount of these chemicals in their blood.
And what kind of health risk are they linked to?
Studies have linked them to a variety of health risks, from kidney and testicular cancer to high cholesterol and thyroid disease. Mothers and young children are especially vulnerable to these chemicals because they can affect reproductive health as well as developmental health in very young children.
Now, the Times analysis found that California has more pockets of PFAS contamination than any other state. And in some places, the chemicals have leached into drinking water supplies. What parts of California have the highest incidence of PFAS in the water?
You'll see that it's relatively widespread across the state, but there are clusters. Los Angeles County, San Bernardino, Riverside, Orange County in particular, the city of Corona, had 8 wells that tested above the EPA's health advisory level for PFAS. The city of Anaheim had to shut down 3 of its wells over concerns about the level of PFAS. If you're a city that gets most of your water from surface water, from, say, a reservoir or a stream, you're typically in a pretty good situation because a lot of surface water is at least currently not testing positive for PFAS. However, if you're very reliant on groundwater and you happen to be near one of these manufacturing hubs, your options are sort of much more restricted. Some water systems have started blending the PFAS-contaminated water with clean water so that ultimately it lowers the levels. Some have shut down wells entirely, and some have started treating the water through water treatment plants. But there are a lot of water systems across California that are quite small and really don't have the money to build a treatment plant that can handle this.
Talking to Anna Phillips, reporter with the LA Times, talking about a Times analysis that found many drinking water sources in California contain toxic chemicals. Is there a way for people to find out how safe their water is? I imagine some people listening and are thinking, oh, great, how do I know if the water coming out of my tap is okay for me to drink?
It's a really tough question to answer. Most people are going to be dependent on the state to conduct more of this testing. You know, this was the first time that California did its own testing of drinking water wells across the state, and they're going to continue to expand that testing. But they have not gotten to a point where they have said, we're going to test every drinking water system or every drinking water well in California. It would be incredibly expensive to do that. It's not as though an individual resident can go out and purchase a test at a pharmacy or even online.
Is there an agreed-upon safe level for PFAS?
There's not, and that's what makes the situation that much more complicated. The chemicals, as we understand them, are currently unregulated by the federal government. And so what's happened is because the EPA has delayed setting a safe drinking water standard, individual states have taken it upon themselves to try and do it for themselves. So states like New Jersey, New Hampshire, they're all much further along in trying to determine, okay, we have this in our water, what's the actual safe limit where people can drink it and be okay? California has started that process, but it's probably a multi-year process, and we're really only at the beginning. On the regulatory side, we're starting to see a lot of interest in Congress to make these chemicals, you know, a known hazard, which would require the EPA to start putting kind of regulations in place that don't exist now.
That's Anna Phillips, reporter with the LA Times. Anna, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Back now with Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Martinez. Apple has 1.4 billion users. Can it entice enough of them to try their new streaming service? Plus, Hollywood assistants are speaking out over low pay and poor working conditions. Let's go on the lot.
God is my witness.
Stick your head out and yell.
You want a chocolate?
All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up.
The Hollywood Reporter's Rebecca Keegan joins us every Wednesday to guide us through the latest showbiz news. Hello, Rebecca.
Hello, A.
All right, let's start off with Apple TV Plus and the bumpy launch of its new streaming service, which debuts November 1st. One of the major shows hoping or helping it to get off the ground is Morning News, and that stars Jennifer Aniston and Reese Witherspoon.
Cue her.
Good morning. I'm bringing you some sad and upsetting news. And while I don't know the details of the allegations...
She's throwing me under the bus.
Mitch Kessler, my co-host and partner of 15 years, was fired today.
You!
Now, this show went through a lot of ups and downs, from the purchasing rights through production. Can you take us through what happened with them?
Well, in 2017, Apple outbid Netflix for the show. And at the time, it seemed to be a clear signal that the tech company was arriving in Hollywood and wanted to make a big splash. However, the early script for the show ended up being scrapped, and there was a consideration that the Me Too movement was just kicking off, and they wanted the storyline for the show to address it. So they ended up changing showrunners on the show and changing the direction dramatically. This is not the only Apple Plus show that has had a showrunner change. Another high-profile one that did is Steven Spielberg's Amazing Stories.
Now, how have these missteps affected the launch of the streaming service?
So far, you know, interest in the service is still high, and Apple has all sorts of ways to get subscribers that other traditional entertainment companies don't, including having the service be free when you buy a new phone. So it's not clear that all of these sort of development issues will affect the way the audience perceives the service. It does matter in terms of Hollywood and your partners in town, you know, wanting to do business with you and seeing you as a place where their creative work will get treated well.
Yeah, one of the things with Apple, though, I mean, it's a tech company and it's trying to launch a streaming service. So in a way, it's trying to get into Hollywood. How has Apple mitigated the learning curve of this whole venture?
Well, they did hire experienced people to run it, Sony TV veterans Jamie Ehrlich and Zach Van Amberg. They priced it very competitively. It'll be about $5 a month, which is cheaper than most of the other streaming services. And they've got deals with names that people are interested in, Oprah Winfrey, Alfonso Cuarón, Justin Lin. So they've tried to sort of align themselves with people who will attract the audience and help them with that learning curve. For them, this is not so much about getting a bunch of new subscribers and in the manner that Netflix did, although of course they want subscribers. It is partly to keep people's relationship with Apple, to keep people buying iPhones as opposed to other types of technology.
Ultimately, what needs to happen to make this a win? Is it just staying in the Apple universe as often and in as many ways as people can?
Yeah, it's kind of a tricky metric. I mean, we do, Wedbush estimates that Apple could attract 100 million subscribers by 2023, and that would generate $7 to $10 billion in revenue from this product. But as we said, it's not about just the revenue and just the subscribers. It's about keeping us all using Apple products in the future.
All right, let's move on now to the Hollywood Reporter's list of the 100 most powerful people in entertainment 2019. We can't get to all 100. We can, though, talk about a few standouts. So let's start with James Cameron, who came in at number 57 and actually gave some pretty hilarious answers to the questions he was asked for the article. Rebecca, tell us about that.
Well, look, James Cameron is my favorite person to interview in Hollywood because he really does not care. He says what's on his mind. We ask everybody the same questions on this list. A couple that we asked him, and by the way, some of his have salty language in them, so I'll just
okay.
I'll just skip those. One we ask everybody is their last big splurge. For James Cameron, it was building a submarine. We also ask everybody, if you find Bob Iger's iPhone, which contact do you call? James Cameron was the only one who said, I can call anybody I want. I don't need Bob Iger's cell phone.
See, that's some big baller talk right there.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, he definitely has that in his corner. What about David Young, the WGA negotiator who made the list at 93?
Yeah, this is he's a newcomer to the list. It's hard to argue that he is not someone who's made a major impact on Hollywood and on the most powerful people in Hollywood. He persuaded more than 7,000 writers to fire their agents and sue the agencies this year, profoundly impacting the industry and the way it does business.
Now, and if we're talking about a list of powerful people, the Obamas probably would have been on it when Barack Obama was president, but him and his wife, a former First Lady Michelle, they are on the most powerful people in entertainment list. Why did they make this particular list?
Yeah, this is their first time making the Hollywood Reporter's top 100 most powerful people in entertainment list. And I hope they've let the goosebumps go down. It's probably pretty much the same as the Nobel for them. but that's because they are newcomers to Hollywood. Their first ever movie that their production company, Higher Ground, backed is the documentary American Factory, which premiered on Netflix in August. And they've backed a number of other projects that they'll be rolling out in the coming years.
Now, you mentioned Bob Iger, Disney's CEO. No surprise, he's number one, right?
Yeah, I mean, it couldn't be anyone else. Look, this year, in addition to all of the success Disney has had on its various platforms, they closed the deal to buy Fox, and they're launching Disney Plus, the company's streaming service, in November.
All right, now let's end on a new hashtag that's making waves, and that's hashtag PayUpHollywood. What's this movement trying to shed a light on?
Well, this movement, which started with people tweeting under the hashtag PayUpHollywood, is Hollywood assistants explicitly calling out their workplaces for low wages that restrict the pipeline of talent into the entertainment industry.
What kind of stories are being shared under this hashtag? I can imagine some pretty terrible horror stories.
Well, it's not so much the horror stories as it is the actual difficulty of living on what most assistants in Hollywood make, which is typically the $12 an hour California minimum wage. They're expected to have a professional wardrobe, use their own cars, their personal credit cards, in these very high-powered settings, and many of them are saying it's just not doable. They need multiple jobs to get by.
So what do you think? Do you think this hashtag and movement can really elicit any change? Because I think the underpaying of Hollywood assistants has probably been an open secret around Hollywood for a while.
It has, but I think, you know, the issue that a lot of the folks that are tweeting about this are trying to make clear is the unintended consequence of underpaying these people, which is that the only people who can afford to take these jobs tend to be people without student debt or people whose parents are supplementing their income. And that narrows in terms of class and racial background, ethnic background, the pipeline of people who can get into these Hollywood jobs. And that's just something that Hollywood doesn't want to do.
Rebecca Keegan is with The Hollywood Reporter. She joins us every Wednesday to talk all things showbiz. Rebecca, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, now to a Pasadena landmark just north of us here at KPCC. The historic Gamble House will now be managed by the city of Pasadena. The University of Southern California had overseen the iconic American Craftsman home for the past five decades. But after years of campaigning, the newly created Gamble House Conservancy will take control. The home originally built for David B. Gamble of the Procter & Gamble dynasty is a prime example of the arts and crafts movement, a style made popular at the turn of the century. The massive structure features stained glass windows and carved wooden furniture. The management company is still pending court approval, but Pasadena Mayor Terry Tornick says it should be a smooth transition. The goal is to complete the transfer by the end of the year.